Brad, Logan, I don't know about you, but I am extremely excited about this episode. Basically, all of our previous conversations have in some way or another led up to the discussion around nutrient density of our foods. And we've lost somewhere between 20 and 50% of the nutritional value in fruits and vegetables over the last 50 to 70 years. That's roughly like a half to 1.5% every year of my life. So as I did the math, because it's easy math, if I lived to like 100, I'd be eating food with zero nutrients. Now, I don't know if it extrapolates out that long in that way, but it was really kind of a mind-blowing stat when I looked it up and looked at some of the research that is behind it. Those are for, you know, things like calcium, magnesium, phosphorus. Those are for some of your macronutrients. What's more scary, and some of the reports even pointed this out, is that pre-1950, we weren't tracking micronutrients in our food. So the only way to do this comparison would be to look at 100 years ago, and some of those micronutrients weren't tracked. And we now know the importance of micronutrients in our diet and how it changes everything from infancy to adulthood, as far as cognitive levels and disease suppression and things like that. So I was really blown away. This is a really great conversation. I know this is part two of our three-part series, You Are What You Eat, and we're leading up to next week, or I believe it's the 12th, we're going to have a special guest who I'm really excited about. She's been all over the country, all over the world, in fact, talking about food and nutrition. And so we're really excited to have her. I know everybody's looking forward to that. So let's dig in here. Welcome, everybody, to the Modern Farming Podcast, where we bring you insights directly from the field about food, agriculture, and the amazing environment we live in. So, Logan, if the food we eat is declining in nutrient value, and obviously bees pollinate many of these crops, is there any concern for the bees or their nutrition or how they do their job to make sure we all have food on the table?
You know, I think they are the different plane of the question, whereas, you know, we're talking about the fruit, and for the bees, we have to look at the flower. And the flower is then, of course, as the fruit is as well, directly affected by the plant's health. And we can look at several different factors as far as nutritional density for bees, from just allowing weeds grow to not feeding sugar water during the times that plants are blooming. Cause you know, what's healthier, something that is all natural, like the nectar from a flower, or feeding them, you know, table sugar. So it's a huge difference in the nutritional value there. And we've already talked about that in a couple of episodes ago, but yeah, you know,
go ahead.
But bees, you know, they require a lot of protein and a lot of lipids, 20 to 30% of protein in their diet to maintain healthy brood rearing. So that means, you know, 3 out of 10 things that they need is protein, and pollen can range from 10% to 40% protein by dry weight. So protein is really easy for them to find if they have good food sources. But the problem is the good food sources that the bees like are often things that we don't like.
Weeds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, for example, no one likes Spanish needle, right? They're annoying. They get on your pants. But Spanish needle is essential for bees during the winter time because it's pretty much the only thing that will be blooming. So it helps them get through really tough times. And so that's the third question out of the three questions beekeepers ask, right? For nutritional density in bees, there's ABC. A, does it yield nectar? B, does it yield pollen? And C, when does it bloom? So those are the three major questions. And, you know, before the show, we were talking about probiotic feeding and gut health in bees. And there are so many studies, even in the past 5 years, very recent studies, where we have learned to essentially just not waste our money unless the bees are sick on probiotics. Because there's just not really solid scientific backings that feeding probiotics on a regular basis actually improves the gut health of bees and improves a colony's overall health. Because whatever we feed them, they just either let it go to waste or they poop it out and it's not found within their system. And then the bees go to the dirt to get those weird and just off the wall nutrients that the hive, the colony is missing in that particular moment.
Yeah. So you said that. Tell us what, like, when you say that, I envision bees, you know, just kind of rolling around in the mud like a pig, you know, like what's happening there? Because when you told me that, I was kind of blown away. It's just something you never think of, you know, and, right. And it makes perfect sense. But how does that work? What are they exactly doing? And how does that, you know, how do they gain those probiotics in that way?
So one way that they do is they'll look for little deposits of water, right? Something that is wet that they can slurp up with their proboscis. The next thing that they do is they try to attach it to their pollen basket, the thing that they use for bringing the pollen back to the hive is this large cluster of hairs on their hind legs. And so they will siphon through the dirt looking through it. And it does look like that they're digging. I get phone calls sometimes. Actually, a couple of weeks ago, January like 15th or 16th, I had to go out to Gainesville area to a homeowners association because they had bees going through bird seed. And there was this film on the bird seed that was supposed to bring nutrients to the birds. And it tasted like peanut butter is what I was told. So it was supposed to be a good taste for the birds. And the bees obviously were finding something. They were rolling around in it, getting it all over their hairs, just like they do with pollen. And they were trying to comb themselves off to put it on their hind legs and treat it as pollen. And it was a protein source, but it was the most odd thing for them to find protein in.
It's amazing. So let me get back. In your experience, is there any, can you tell or can the bees tell when a crop or a flowering crop? So like what I'm picturing here is we get a citrus crop, right? Mm-hmm. And it's flowering and the smell is just, you know, intoxicating. Everybody loves it. Do the bees, are we able to tell that the bees are attracted to a tree that has a higher, you know, like a nutritional value or a higher Brix level? Mm-hmm. Is there anything that points to bees really seeking out like a high Brix crop?
Well, I will give an example of the way that they forage, and maybe that will answer it best. So bees' vision is shifted to the right, so they can't see the color red, but they can see ultraviolet. So if a tree yields high volumes, that will really attract them because nectar and pollen both give off an ultraviolet, I won't say a light, but almost like it radiates it, and the bees can see that and they're drawn to it. And likewise, the color of the bloom is specifically trying to attract the pollinator. Mm-hmm. And so plants will yield in a way to make it even more so attractive, meaning the nutritional needs of the bees. Because like, for example, a couple episodes ago, I'm pretty sure we talked about maple trees and how, yeah, you know, incredible maple trees are in protein. The bees know maple's good for them comparatively to other things. And they will seek out the things that we know that they like, we know are high in protein sources, that are high in volumes of nectar. Now, my wife's grandma, she often jokes with me, have you asked the bees? Have the bees told you that? But it's definitely visible in their activities and in the behaviors that they do, and that they will fly over things. Now, for example, this may be the most direct way to answer the question. Watermelons. Watermelons are not high in nutrients for bees, but watermelons need bees. So sweat bees that actually like watermelons will work the watermelons much quicker than a honeybee will. And a honeybee will fly over the watermelons to go to gallberry.
Interesting.
So I wish I could talk to the bees, but based off of their behavior, I will say yes, the bees absolutely know what is higher in nutritional value and nutritional density as far as what they're looking for when they forage.
Yeah. And you said that the maple was like a steak for a bee, right? Is that what, that what you said? That's so great. That's so great. I'm, you know, if you want to be really cool, like just start quoting some of the things you learned from Logan on this show, because I tell people that and they're like, how do you know this stuff? I got a guy. His name's Logan.
I'll be honest with you. I've been listening to what you guys talk about soil, and my citrus trees haven't been better.
Awesome.
They're doing great now.
Well, yeah, that perfect segue. So, Brad, let me ask you this. You know, the consensus among research is that the reason for the decline in nutrients in our food, right, 20 to 50% over the last 50, 70 years. I get that's a huge number, right? Like that's to me, that's a massive number, especially if you play it out another 50 years. Because like I said, if we're losing like 0.5% to 1% of the nutritional value of our food. Now, a lot of the research is done on fruits and veggies, right? A lot of things we eat. Citrus, apples, peaches, strawberries, tomatoes, a lot of that stuff. So if we're losing that much every year, let's just say it's 0.5% of the nutrients in the food we consume, we're losing every year. Take that out for another 50 years. I'm going to live another 50 years. I'm sure of it. What, you know, yeah, knock on wood, right? So what the consensus is in all the research is that the reason for the decline has to do with several factors. Okay. One of those is that we've bred these variety of fruits and vegetables to yield and for like disease suppression or for defensive properties against a specific known disease or pest. We're not necessarily breeding them for nutrients. Do you believe that? Is that consensus correct? What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, and we have. I mean, we've bred these plants and crops to essentially where they don't need the carbon and biology factor to grow. So we can just focus on nutrients, NPK, basic minor nutrients, and we can produce yield. But when we do that, when carbon and biology isn't a factor in the growth of that crop, then we lose the flavonoids, the amino acids, the proteins, the enzymes, all those essential things that put the nutrition and the flavor and the taste in our crops. And so it's just an easy out in my opinion.
I did
want to touch on Logan's talk about the soil and the bees. I don't know if you've ever heard this, but my wife brought it up to me years ago, even before I was into soil, that pregnant women would go out and actually eat soil from the garden just out of, because they felt that they need to. In other words, they didn't feel internally, they didn't think they were getting the nutrients from what they were eating. They would go out and eat dirt to get the nutrients from their food. And I've heard Elaine Ingham, who was one of my, who I studied back in the beginning of this, the compost tea soil food web lady, that would say, you should eat 6 pounds of soil just that's attached to your food. When you go pull food, if you're growing your own food from your garden, when you pull that carrot out of the soil, do not wash it off. Just eat that. You need to eat that soil. And she says 6 pounds is the number. And that's just something that has stuck in my head over the years of studies and what I'm doing. But I just wanted to bring that up as we were talking about eating dirt.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, you know, it is funny because, you know, we don't really think about, you know, what does the dirt have that we may need, you know? And then as silly and crazy as it sounds, I may say something that's a little controversial, but, you know, I would be more comfortable with my wife being pregnant and eating dirt that I knew that was clean dirt than maybe some of the things that you see on the grocery store. And, you know, even pollen has like 200 different compounds, and it's not just protein, from fatty acids to minerals to enzymes. And, you know, I was mentioning a couple of things to you guys before we started recording. There's two major bacteria in the bee's midgut that are really important. I'm not going to even try to say their names. I always mispronounce them. But I mean, even bacteria is important for our nutrients. And that's weird to say that, you know, a lot of times bacteria has that negative connotation to it. Like bacteria is what makes you sick, but there's good bacteria too.
Yeah. Yeah, no, we talk about it on the farm a lot. You know, a lot of the biologicals we use, they're made of bacteria. And you're absolutely right. There's a lot of people who say, well, why the heck would I want to add bacteria, Nick? Isn't that something I'm trying to get away from? Like anything, there's good and bad, right? There's good bacteria, there's bad bacteria. There's good fungi, there's bad fungi. I just think it's interesting, or not interesting. I think it's mind-blowing to me, again, that if you look across the board, we've talked about it several times as well, you know, health in the United States, or if you look around the globe, is declining, right? We have more people with, you know, all these health issues, high blood pressure, you know, diabetes, liver disease, heart disease, cancer. And I am a true believer that a lot of this comes from the foods we eat. And I don't think it like happens, you know, in your 20s. I believe it happens from the day you're born. And even there's some studies that are talking about as an infant still in the womb, that the whole nutrient consumption starts in the womb, obviously, which is why, you know, you talk about ladies eating soil when they're pregnant, that's really a thing, because that's where it starts. And so I just look at this whole nutrient density of our foods, and it's in a massive decline. I'm talking, these numbers are so huge. I would classify it as a massive decline in a probably a food emergency. And then I look at the way we farm, and we've said it before as well, that the whole ag system is not built to make us healthier, right? It's just not. And it's not that anyone's setting out to say, look, let's make this so efficient that we're not making healthy food. That's not what happens. But I think the efficiency takes the focus off high nutrition, taste. Brad mentioned it before, flavonoids, enzymes. Thing is about taste. We're just focusing on nutrient content. So we're putting a value to a calcium or an iron or something like that. But what's the value of the taste? I mean, I think a lot of people, and it's really interesting when you see these studies where they go to inner cities and people who only shop at, you know, the local dime store or something, they've only ever eaten something that comes in a box that they have to microwave, right? That is their food experience. And if that's what's happening in the world, I just feel really bad. And I think we could do better, but the system is made that way, right? It's made, we flash freeze food. We package it very quickly. We get these perfect little boxes that fit nicely into a microwave, and off you go. And we're feeding the world. And these companies tend to make a fair amount of money. I just know we can do better. And I know it's happening, right, Brad? So I know there's things that we're tracking. I just wonder, is nutrient density something that you're actively tracking with your growers? Is it something that you look at, or how do you look at that?
Yeah, and there are several different ways. There's some really cool new testing. I typically am looking at it just through Brix, which is mostly sugars, but it's also showing nutrient content. So it's dissolved solids. It's anything that's in the fruit that is a solid that is not water. And most of that is water, but a big part of that is all the nutrients in your food. So if your Brix level is higher, then your nutrient density is higher. We've talked about it in previous podcasts. There is some new technology that's I thought it would already be here. It's close where the housewife will be able to go into a grocery store and be able to shoot a blue beam of light into different fruits and give her a nutrient density reading so she can make a judgment of how much she's willing to spend for this carrot or that carrot or that carrot. And that's what'll make the difference. That's what will move growers, incentivize growers to grow more nutrient dense crops rather than just focus on yield.
Yeah. It's really interesting that you say that because it's really taking it out of industry hand, right? Like if we could walk in as consumers, with a handheld device that tells us the nutrient, at least the nutrient level, right? It might not tell us how much calcium, iron, magnesium, right, everything in there, right? But it'll give us some sort of reading. It's just really interesting how we're going to bypass or potentially bypass industry. And really, at the end of the day, I wonder what industry is going to say about it. You know, are they going to crack down on Brad in the stores, you know, scanning all of his oranges and all of his avocados before he buys it? You know, I think that's really, it's amazing that we're going to have that technology. One, it's amazing. Two, I think it's a shame that we have to invent this technology because we know we can grow healthier, more nutrient-rich food. The examples are abundant. If you jump on social media where many people are getting their information nowadays, there's a lot of challenge to this whole nutrient testing, this nutrient density testing. There's one group or maybe two or three groups together. You get your organics, regenerative, your biologicals, right? And they seem to be on one side of the tracks where conventional farming and, you know, big ag, as you say, is on the other side of the argument. And whenever I see these images and our friend up there in Georgia, you know, we see this a lot, but whenever he or anyone like him shows the image of his organically grown, biologically grown citrus versus your store-bought citrus, the numbers are not even close, right? It's like you have to eat six tangerines to get to his one. If you're going pound for pound on nutrients, what's interesting is there's a whole group of people on social media that do tell him that that's not a fair fight, right? That he's taking his citrus that is perfectly manicured with his own hands and treated very well versus something that's 2 miles away. So they're saying that he's not comparing apples to apples. He's comparing apples to oranges. No pun intended, but he's comparing two different soil types from two different areas. And I get that scientifically. Yeah. Maybe I get that, but why does it matter? Right. He is showing proof and many like him, and it doesn't just start. It doesn't end with citrus, right? We can even see it in feed that we're feeding cows. You know, there's a lot of alfalfa that's grown organically or with a regenerative background or biologically grown, and it has a higher feed value that we can quantify, right? There's a relative feed value that most of these alfalfa growers, especially when they sell to a dairy, there's a relative feed value that we can test. We've shown higher numbers in that. We've shown higher numbers in Brix levels. We've shown higher numbers in organically grown citrus or tomatoes. To me, it's not whether the science is correct, right? I'm not auditioning for my PhD here, right? I don't care necessarily about the science. What I care about is proof of concept. And we have proven time and time again that you can grow a very nutrient dense crop organically, biologically, using a lot of, you know, a lot of alternative practices, if you will, composting, cover crops, to Logan's point, letting the weeds grow, right? So I just wonder, you know, to you or Brad or even Logan, either one of you, I mean, what are your thoughts there on that argument? Because I know everyone listening right now probably has somebody in their family, somebody in their circle that says, oh yeah, but that data is not proven, right? And there's a lot of people who think like, well, hey, if they can grow really healthy, nutrient-dense food, it would just be the norm. It would just be the standard. Unfortunately, that's not the way it works. So I'm just curious on your guys' thoughts on the fact that there are a whole group of people out there challenging whether organically, biologically, or, you know, biodynamically grown crops are higher in nutrient value.
Yeah, and it's happened so slowly over time, just in my lifetime, you know, over 50 years. It all will go back to carbon levels in the soil, organic matter. All of that will relate when you look at carbon levels, organic matter on a soil test. It is going to correlate with productivity. And we were all kind of taught, I was taught in college 40 years ago, we were told to degrade your soil as slowly as possible. They didn't think you could build it. You when you farmed, you were tearing it down, and that's just something you had to deal with. Even though carbon and organic matter and biology wasn't understood then like it is today, they knew something to do with that organic material was affecting quality growth, and they didn't think you could build it back. And now, with what you just said, with cover crops and compost and even biological inputs, you can build soil faster than ever was thought possible, especially with, well, like Logan will talk about, even with weeds, just letting weeds grow in your fallow season in row cropping makes a world of difference, rather than just going out there and doing recreational disking in the summertime because you don't want to see weeds growing out there. They are doing something for your soil. They're building carbon, and planting cover crops, whether it's within a perennial crop or in the fallow season, it builds carbon so much faster than science thought was possible. And we've just learned this really in the last decade. And that's a thing. That's a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah. So how many crops are you working with that are, let's say, like modern varieties? I mean, not organic, native, land race varieties. How many groves or crops are you working with that are, you know, modern hybrids or newer hybrids, two decades, a decade old kind of stuff?
Yeah, I work with, well, citrus is predominant what I consult with, but I work with watermelons and corn and peppers, and I work with sod. I mean, we're using these practices and growing grass to put in our yards. You know, I have a client that's growing cover crops within a sod and using less fertilizer. So it's not just food production. It's just really within everything that grows.
Yeah, no, I agree. And the reason why I ask that is how many of, because back to the argument, excuse me, which is the reason why we're losing the nutrients in our food is because of the GMO or the varieties that we selected for yield, for pounds, for tonnage, right? For mass production. Those varieties were not selected for their nutrient content. But I know for a fact, and I challenge anybody to say that we can, even with those newer varieties that were selected for yield, not nutrients, we can make those more nutritious, right? With the practices we use and the way we know how to farm, the technology that you and I are both using, we know we can raise even the Brix level of a genetically modified crop, right?
Sure. And we typically don't go down the road of why they are genetically modified, so we can use certain chemicals that won't affect those crops. So if we genetically modified a crop that we can spray glyphosate over the top of and it doesn't affect it, well, that's affecting nutrient. That's affecting nutrient uptake. So there's things that we can do carbon and biologically wise that can make manganese and zinc more available to even the plants that don't necessarily need it. But we can do things to make to make that nutrition get into the plant and make it healthier and more nutritious.
Right. No, I agree 100% because we've seen it so many times, and I've worked with a lot of GMO crops and, you know, not that we ever really worked with seed crops to look at their nutrient content, but when you get to the final end user, like for grain corn, if you were going to feed that corn, we do have a nutritional value to that corn. And we knew long ago that, you know, there were certain times where we could shoot certain nutrients to raise the feed value of even a corn. And that would be a genetically modified corn, right? So I know we can do it. My question to both of you, just knowing the industry we're all in, the examples are there. The information is there. The technology is there. The products are there. And they're readily available. Top to bottom, east to west, you could find these products. They're not difficult to source anymore. 20 years ago, they were, right? Guys like Brad and myself were not difficult to find anymore. 20 years ago, they were. Knowing all of that, why is the industry not just making a wholesale change to grow crops that will produce a higher nutrient value?
I think maybe it has to even do with my industry and the all-encompassing word of organic. I think if you're intellectually honest with yourself, the three of us, anyone that you ask, when you ask, do you want your product to be the highest value in nutrients? If you're honest, you would say yes. Of course. However, especially in the beekeeping realm, there's the all-encompassing word organic, and I'm not considered organic in the beekeeping realm because I want to try to remember and properly use the phrase that Brad used, and that is using a chemical that will not affect the crop. So anytime you use chemicals in a beehive, it is specifically labeled for a certain pest, and you're not allowed to use it unless that label says that it is honey safe. In the USDA, through many rigorous trials and experiments with various different agencies, they make sure that it will not affect the honey. And you know, I tell people all the time, whether or not it affects the honey is irrelevant to the comb, what holds the honey. Comb is like a sponge, and bees are like a sponge. They soak up anything you put in the hive, and it will stay there. It will stay in the comb. It will be in the bees. So you have to be really careful in what you put in your hive to treat for these pests. And you don't want your honey supers on, because if you are a good, honest businessman and you care about your customers, you will not be selling them honey that has had chemical treatments in it. And so that you have the people that do not do it right, and they make a bad name for the process. And then you have the pendulum effect, right? So the people like me that try their best to do what's right, to follow the label — label's the law in Florida, by the way — and then the pendulum goes over here. People misuse chemicals. People, they try to harvest sugar water honey and sell it. Those are two different problems, but they both affect the value of the honey significantly. And then you have all the way over here, the people that refuse to treat their bees. And in my opinion, both sides are mistreating their bees, using too many chemicals, and the bees die from chemical overexposure. Then the people that have bees, they're dying because the pests are just overtaking the entire hive. And then they say they have organic honey. But me in the middle, I have organic honey because I don't treat my honey with chemicals. I have different comb that is specifically for honey harvesting that has never seen chemicals in the time that I've used it. So technically I have organic honey, but the people over here say they're the only ones that have true organic honey because they use no chemicals whatsoever. And yeah, it's just two people on opposite sides. This person loves the chemicals they use. They preach by it. These people preach by the non-use of chemicals and how harmful it is, and just the negative connotation of just using an umbrella and not looking at the deeper context of each individual issue.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think my thing is, look, you're a father, and you got really young kids. I've got, you know, teenage kids. There isn't a doubt, like, right? There's no doubt that we would always say if there was a store shelf and it says, you know, higher nutrition value, lower nutrition value, two apples. There's no question, right? We're going to go for the higher nutritional value. What I think is happening, and unfortunately it's happening too slowly, but what I think is happening is that's starting to change. And I think we're starting to look at that. Obviously we know that in the industry, especially with, you know, biologicals that are coming out and just the understanding of, I hate to steal Dr. Elaine's, but the soil food web, right? The soil's microbiome. We understand that at such a higher level than we ever have before. And it seems like every week we're learning a little bit more. What I can't wait to see is, and I think consumers have a role in this. I think all of you who are listening are watching this. We have a role. So if you have a relationship with your grocery store, and I know a lot of us don't anymore, but some of us do, right? Some people do know their store managers. Some people do know the produce managers. If you have a relationship, or if you just see those folks walking around your local grocery store, ask them, tell them, because I think more of the conversation that happens at the grocery store, the more they can ask their suppliers. Their suppliers are huge, right? And you and I are kind of tiny little people, because we buy, you know, a few hundred bucks worth of groceries when we walk in the door. It seems like more and more every day. But what I'm getting at is we're the consumers, right? We're the customer. We drive what is being grown. So if everyone just stops buying strawberries for the next 2 or 3 months, they're going to start to think about how many strawberries they need to grow next year, right? So we are the driver of that commodity. And I think we could do a better job of asking and demanding a better quality product. If you walked into your hotel room and it was only, like, you know, halfway clean, you'd probably call the front desk and tell them, hey, this place wasn't really cleaned, right? Same thing in your car. If you paid for a full tank of gas, 50 bucks, whatever it costs you, and then you get in and it was only half full, you'd go into the gas station and say, hey, what happened to my other 25 bucks, right? I only got half the gas when it said it was full. It's the same thing. We're only getting a small portion of what should be available in our food. And I don't care what that is, right? I don't care if it's genetically modified. I don't care if it's organic. I don't care if it's biodynamic. Whatever that crop is grown, however that crop is grown, we know for a fact we can increase the nutrient value of that. And I think it's up to us as consumers. Obviously, in a couple of weeks from now, when we talk to our guest here, she's going to tell us the same thing. She's done a lot of work in Washington, D.C. I think we have an ear. I think we have several ears in D.C. now. I think we have the ear of the big five in agriculture. I think every day I open up my phone and there's an email from one of the big, you know, ag producers, and they've got a new product, and it's not totally biological, but they're leaning that direction. If you look at where all the capital investment is going right now in agriculture, a lot of that is going to biological products. So I know it's happening on the ground. It looks like it's new, and this little niche market, sort of like organic was 20 years ago. But I think this thing is ramping up really fast. Obviously, I'm really excited. I'm really excited to have both of you on every week with us and talk about these things, because I think we need to educate the consumer more. And if you're the consumer, ask more questions, right? Demand a better product, because we know we can give it. So, hey guys, great conversation. Again, I am extremely excited about our guest here. That'll be our first guest. So hopefully we don't, muck that all up with technology, but we're going to do our best. Thanks everybody for jumping on to listen to us. If you haven't already, please jump on. It's thegreengenefoundation.org. if you jump on the website there and you click on the podcast button, you'll see the email subscriber list. Please jump on there and you'll be able to get all the updated information about when we launch an episode, when a new episode comes out, and of course, where you can find us on Spotify and all the podcasting websites, and also, of course, YouTube. If you haven't seen us on YouTube, we thought that there was some level of subscriber that we needed to have to be on YouTube. Shockingly, I was wrong. We don't. So please, if you haven't checked out the Green Gene Foundation on YouTube, go and find them, subscribe, like them, do whatever you got to do to get the notification when we launch there. But very shortly, in the next day or so, we'll probably have another episode loaded up and we'll keep them coming. So thanks everybody for supporting us. We can't thank the Green Gene Foundation enough. Thanks, Brad, Logan, for being with me again, and we'll see you in a couple weeks.
Take care.